Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me, Carolyn Yeager, for another edition of the Heretics Hour. It's August 4th, 2014. It was just about this time that World War I got underway 100 years ago in August. Anyway, today is the day the British and the Belgians decided to start things off with their royals getting together along with the commoner presidents from France and Germany and making some speeches and putting out flowers, I suppose, and meeting in cemeteries. So I'm going to talk about that. You know, World War I is something that I really want to get into this year during the 100th anniversary. But as I'm reminded once again, these countries have got activities and events going on throughout the next 4 years, or at least in the next 2 years, because of certain things that happened during the war, you know, during that war. And then they're going to commemorate those things at that time. So it's a kind of a four-year 100th anniversary. So there's plenty of time to do things, but I don't want to put it off. So I have a few things I can say today based on what the news brings to me. And so the Belgian King Philippe and Queen Mathilde welcomed German President Joachim Gauck under cloudy skies for the late morning ceremony at the Allied Memorial. Allied Memorial amid pomp and military honor. Anyway, you know, that's the way they do these things. And this is one story, I think is from the AP, that I found. There's actually, the thing I want to say first is that you'd think that there's very little interest in this. The news stories come on, they're on the, you know, like top of the news, and then disappeared very quickly. Because people aren't really clicking on them, I guess. That's how they judge those things. People are not that interested. It's very obvious that it's just the official establishment that feels they need to mark this and do what they do. But the people themselves are not too interested. And you know, we have this war, so to speak, going on in Ukraine. We've got this war against Gaza in Israel. We've just got all these things going on. And when you try to get people interested in what happened 100 years ago, well, I can understand that people would say, well, let's pay attention to what's going on today. It really is more important. But I'm very, you know, if you're interested in history, you should be interested in this. And there's it's the same problem, World War I, as we have with World War II, and that the historical account that is accepted and that the media produces is distorted, not as bad as World War II continues to be distorted, because a lot of the terrible propaganda that was put out during the 1914 to 18 war has been corrected, and people know that it's not true. But you see, we start out here with Belgium, and Belgium is still getting all this sympathy for all that it suffered, supposedly, because it was not a part of, it didn't declare war on anybody, but Germany, this is the way it's put, Germany invaded neutral Belgium on August 4th, that's today, 1914, I guess that's why this is the day that they're doing this, as part of a planned attack on France. And by nightfall, Britain had joined the war. Well, they were all talking about it. They all knew what they were going to do. But Belgium is considered still poor little Belgium, where I don't know. I'm going to cover some things. I'll wait till I get to them. But as far as I know, the Germans had this Schlieffen plan already worked out, and they had to go into France through Belgium, so they had to go into Belgium, and I don't know that they did any terrible things there, but it's portrayed still today that they that poor Belgium just suffered terribly, and it had to be at the hands of the Germans, but actually the British caused more damage, I think, in Belgium than anybody else. However, I'm not really going to go into all this history, so I haven't brushed up on that. But Gauck, you know, he's the president of Germany, and he's representing Germany, and he is so good at taking the blame and being the fall guy, letting Germany be the fall guy for everything, and he goes right along with it. And he spoke, and he said it opened Pandora's box, and that he said it is anything but self-evident to stand and talk to you on this day. Well, to me, that means he's saying Germans, it's just, isn't it something that we're not outcasts, that we're that I'm able to come here and talk to you on this day after the way we were responsible for all that bad things that happened then. That's what he's saying, and that's what Germany goes along with. Now, about this war, it wasn't expected to last long. Everybody who got started into it thought it was just going to be a short thing. They'd get out there, they'd fight it out. Everybody thought they were going to win. I don't know about Britain, but Germany thought it would win, and France and Russia thought they would win. They had a good chance at it because they were both going to be against Germany. But instead of that, of course, it turned into this long, miserable four-year affair with 14 million lives lost, European lives, and 7 million troops left permanently disabled. So, let's see. It says that the Great War, as it came to be known at that time, is now often depicted as senseless slaughter without a big moral cause that claimed and estimated all these lives. Well, that's true. It was a senseless slaughter, and it didn't have a moral cause. They tried to invent one, and they're still inventing that same moral cause, because as this article says, British Prime Minister David Cameron sought to debunk that notion that it was senseless slaughter without a cause. And he said in his, he told the BBC here, I guess, this is a, he was being interviewed previous to today, I think. He said, although, maybe it was this morning, I don't know, although there was an enormous amount of waste and loss of life, there was a cause that young men rallied to at the beginning of the war, which was the idea that Europe shouldn't be dominated by one power, that a country, a small country like Belgium, shouldn't be simply snuffed out. My God, total bunk, you know, as if it were Germany that wanted to dominate Europe. But Germany was becoming stronger. It wanted to be recognized. Kaiser Wilhelm II was very patriotic, and of course he was related to the Russian Tsar and to the British King and Queen and all of that stuff. So this was like a family affair, and he wanted to get the proper respect for his country, Germany, but they weren't trying to dominate, but it was British policy, had been for a long time, to prevent any nation, any European nation to dominate in Europe, because it was bad for British influence there. Britain was using it didn't necessarily dominate, but it wanted to be the one that could influence what was actually going to go on, and didn't want any European nation to have more power than it did in Europe. So, you know, everything gets turned around, and here we have, you know, these news stories, still the same things being said. It makes me really sick about this David Cameron. Yeah, you know, I'll never think a decent thought about it, not that I did anyway, or do, but, you know, that's that's a ridiculous thing to say, because most everybody else is trying to be a little more, is trying to emphasize the reconciliation and not the blame, but they can't quite cover it up, so it comes out. As, for example, let's see what I've already said here. It's Monday ceremony was in Liege in Belgium, and that's significant since the battle for the forts around the city meant the first delay for Germany's enveloping move through Belgium with their Schlieffen plan. The Belgians put up more of a fight than the Germans expected, I take it, and slowed them down. And now the Belgians are being praised for all their great contribution to the war and all their suffering and so on because of it, because they were chosen to be the first country that Germany entered. So always, always they make sure, no matter where, they don't come out and say, bad Germany, you caused the war. They still imply it every step of the way. And it absolutely is not true, because as I said in a previous program not too long ago, some documents have been either discovered or noticed or something, or come available now that show that various things that France, the leader of France wanted war with Germany. He thought France could grab some territory and could benefit from that. And they worked with Russia. They allied with Russia in that, and Russia wanted the war too. Wanted to have a war with Germany because it also had some plan on how it was going to benefit. And they thought with the two of them on either side of Germany that they would be able to succeed at that. So Germany was pretty much forced into it because of what happened in Austria in Serbia, which I might go into a little bit later. So Gauck, then back to our dear German president, he was in his words that he said at this affair, he called the German plan hapless and deplored German actions against civilians and cities its forces passed through during the early weeks of the war. Well, hapless is understood as unfortunate or ill-starred or doomed. These all seem a lot stronger words than hapless, which seems like kind of an innocent sounding word, but accepting that the Germans did bad things to the civilians and in the cities in the beginning of the early weeks of the war. I didn't look into that. I don't know what he's exactly referring to. So on another program, we'll have to look at that. But at the end of, I guess he feels, though, too, like he has to say those kind of things. He has to. So he does. Otherwise, they might not invite him again. By the end of autumn in 1914, the sides had dug in because of this resistance in Belgium. You know, if Belgium had not done that and allowed the Germans to move right through, maybe the war would have been over sooner and everybody could have gone home and all this horror would not have happened. But see, now because it went the way it did, they have to make out like it's Germany's fault, it's the only way it could have gone, and therefore make heroes out of those who prolonged the war, just like the United States coming in became heroic for prolonging the war. But so it went on, and I'll move on to another article. This is today what they were doing in Britain. Britain seems to be the country that is doing the most commemorating about this war. And, of course, it's very important to them because they lost a lot of lives in that war, and they dragged it out wanting to get the U.S. in there. And they ended up with a victory, but it was very, very costly. So it means a lot in Britain, and they have to paint themselves as heroes, and they have to paint the Germans as villains. So it says about what happened in Britain today. Millions of households were encouraged to turn off their lights from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. and to light a single candle inspired by a remark by Britain's then Foreign Minister Edward Grey on the eve of war that, quote, the lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. Well, I don't know how old he was, but he certainly painted a gloomy picture there. And so it says a single candle will be left on the steps of 10 Downing Street. Well, this has already taken place. The official residence of Prime Minister David Cameron. And in the nearby Tower of London, there's a striking art installation there made up of hundreds of thousands of ceramic poppies, one for each British soldier killed in the war. And they poured out of the tower into the surrounding moat. Okay, so all these ceramic poppies came floating out of this Tower of London and landed in the water surrounding it and floated, I suppose. Cameron began a day of remembrance by attending service at Glasgow Cathedral. But he said there, it is right to remember the extraordinary sacrifice of a generation, and we are all indebted to them because their most enduring legacy is our liberty. See, again, more bull from Cameron. In the first place, by 100 years later, by now, with all the reconciliation, so-called, they should not be talking about how they sacrificed for liberty, because their liberty was never threatened during World War I. Britain's liberty was never threatened. They were fighting for power reasons and trade and financial reasons and so on, and economic reasons. But then when they get all those men, young men, all the flower of Britain's youth killed, then they have to put a lot of stuff on it and keep it there so that they won't be blamed. The leaders of that time won't be blamed for all that, for killing all those British young men, and a bunch of other young men, too. See, the Germans aren't allowed to do this, so they don't fall into all this hypocrisy. But the British are the best at it, the best of all. Because now here, even Prince William, Duke of Cambridge, gave a speech this morning. And he was trying to be, you know, conciliatory and so on. But even he had to say some things and I'm going to repeat just these few things that he said in his speech. It wasn't very long, but I'm not going to read it all. It's the usual nothing, you know, that they make these speeches out of. You know, somebody helps him write it, and it's just, you know, all politically correct and so on, and, you know, nice. But here in his third paragraph, he says, here where we gather today honors the city of Liege and its people for their courageous resistance in 1914, and also all Belgians who fought, suffered, and died in the Great War. So, you know, they're again showing those who fought against Germans as the courageous ones, you know, who resisted aggression, is what they're saying, plain out, you know. And the Germans can't and are not about to correct that or complain about that. He goes on, Prince William, your great sacrifice, he's speaking there in Belgium to the Belgian queen and king and, you know, and the people. Your great sacrifice and your contribution to eventual victory was pivotal. Belgium's resistance in 1914 allowed the Allies to regroup and draw up the battle lines, which became the infamous trenches. And then, you know, he talks a little bit about the trenches leaving a scar on their land. But here again, you know, the Allies were able to, were working together for good, on the good side. And then finally, he says, he mentions a good deed done by a Belgian landowner to the German army, saying, this evening at St. Symphorian Cemetery in Mons, Catherine and I will visit a site which was donated by a Belgian landowner to the German army so that soldiers from both sides could be buried near where they fell. And, you know, that's nice. That's good. But, of course, they're praising themselves, their side, for being big and being good, you know, doing something even like burying the German soldiers is a great good deed that they've done. But here's the really anti-German part that we finally get to. In my opinion, here's Prince William. He's saying, in Europe, the transition from war to lasting peace has taken time. Edith Cavell was a British nurse who saved soldiers from each side. On the night before she faced a German firing squad, she said, I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anyone. And then he says a bit more about it. But there it is, you know, he has to bring out that this good British nurse who was helping everyone was executed by the Germans. I don't know, I've heard of her. I know I've read about her, but then I forget. So I'm not sure exactly what her story was. But, you know, the Germans felt that she was something dangerous. And I think she ended up in a, no, that would be a different war. I don't know. And then he says, after a few more words, he says, the fact that the presidents of Germany and Austria are here today and that other nations, then enemies, are here too, bears testimony to the power of reconciliation. Well, to me, this is, might sound nice, it might sound innocent, but it's reinforcing that Germany and Austria are the odd men out. The fact that Germany and Austria could be represented there with these all these great allied nations, you know, shows the power of reconciliation. You know, they just keep Germany and Austria down, and the whole thing is, what was Austria supposed to do? It was a damn Serbian who assassinated their heir to the throne and his pregnant wife. You know, nobody remembers that. And then Russia, they try to paint it differently now. But Russia, Wilhelm II's cousin, Tsar, now I've forgotten, Nicholas. No, I don't know if he's Nicholas or a different one. Was on Serbia's side and was defending Serbia. And if Austria went into Serbia in order to punish the Serbia a little bit for that act, well, they were going to retaliate. Russia was standing up for Serbia. And that was a stupid thing to do. Do they ever talk about that and all that stupidity? No, because the whole thing is, you know what, this war should be by now, as I already said in the beginning, and I'll say again, should be portrayed as a foolish waste and a misunderstanding and a bunch of egotistical leaders playing around and thinking they can have a short war and get what they wanted out of it. And then they ended up slaughtering all these white European young men and then some women and children too and probably some old people too. This thing finally... William finally ends with, we were enemies more than once in the last century, and today we are friends and allies. We salute those who died to give us our freedom. See, now, who died to give them their freedom? Not the Germans, not the Austrians, because they were against freedom, according to the British point of view and what William is saying here. So those who died to give us our freedom are only the British, the Belgians, the French, the Russians, whatever, against those evil Huns and Habsburgs. And he says, we will remember them, our own heroes. And then I add here, as long as Germany continues to foot the bill for Europe. Yeah, you know, because that's what's actually going on here while these guys weren't around there patting themselves on the back. And what's so sickening, if Germany were a country that would stand up for itself like the others do, they wouldn't still be saying these kind of things. But they won't do it. They actually, I think they like it. Because they go along with the, it's all a part of the one world order, and that's a, you know, everything, every time the Germans, any kind of German nationalism is anti-one world order, so they're against it. They're against it, too. They're never going to stand up for their what is supposedly their own country. So then we have the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, and he got in on it, too. He wasn't there today. He's not joining in this like he did with the D-Day celebration, or commemoration. But he spoke last week sometime, and he gave a speech about it. And he said the 1914 and 1918 war should be seen as a cautionary tale. He said it serves as a reminder of what aggression and selfishness, exorbitant ambitions of heads of state and political elites prevailing over common sense can lead to. Now, you know, I would go along with that. I think, well, that's good. But, you know, he's not talking about Russia. He's talking about the Western countries, all of them, you know, Britain, France, Germany, Austria, whatever. They're the ones who were ambitious and didn't use common sense. But we know that because of what follows. He said history proved time and again that an unwillingness to listen to each other and respect each other's interests can have huge costs. Well, you know, that's good. I agree with that. He said Russia had always sought peace but would repel any outside attack. Well, it's not true that Russia has always sought peace. Russia wanted war with Germany, as I just said, and it was helped by France. So, then Putin says violence breeds violence. Well, that's another good statement. Can't argue with that. But here, he comes to defend Russia's role in World War I, wrongly, in my opinion. He says, on the eve of World War I, Russia did its best to persuade Europe to solve the conflict between Serbia and Austria-Hungary peacefully, without blood. Well, if what he calls Russia trying to act like a peacemaker, that meant no punishment for Serbia, because Russia insisted that Austria-Hungary could not blame Serbia, could not do anything to Serbia, and that didn't satisfy Austria in that the royal family there. And I think you can imagine that to be the case. And Russia should not have have protected Serbia that way, but they had some kind of an agreement. You know, they were allies. And also, as I said on that program a couple of weeks back, in talking about those documents that have come to light, or at least come into the attention of the news or of me, there were documents showing that Tsar, whichever one he was, I don't think he was Nicholas. I think he had a different name. That Russia's security, intelligence and security, which is very active and big, was actually paid who's that guy's name who did the assassination of Franz Ferdinand? His name is well known, but now I'm not going to be able to think of it. I don't have it down. But that the actual assassin who was known, who confessed, and who they caught, and so on, who killed Ferdinand and his pregnant wife, in a pure assassination. I mean, there was no this couple hadn't done anything except to be Austrian royalty. He actually was engaged by the Russian secret police or something to do that. So the Russians were in on that because, as I said, it comes out that Russia wanted to invoke a war with Germany. So Putin is not going to admit any of that. So he covers up his own country's interests just like the others do. And he says, but Russia was not listened to. Yeah, Russia was trying to solve the conflict peacefully, but they didn't listen to Russia. And then Russia, he says, it, meaning Russia, had to respond to the challenge of defending the brotherly Slavic people, defending itself and its citizens from an outside threat. See, that's as much BS, or even worse BS, than what David Cameron is spouting off, and by far worse than what Prince William is saying. So he has no I can't think of the word. He goes into extremism when he starts talking about Russian history. I mean, it's totally, totally crazy, and it certainly doesn't reflect well on him. Now I got a little bit more here. I thought that was the end of my World War One stuff, but I don't know if I want. Okay, here's a little more. Now here's something about France and France's hypocrisy. Everybody's gonna have to get everybody in here. It was on August 3rd, yesterday, that the German Empire declared war on France. And they keep playing up how Germany declared war first. Germany declared war on France. Well, they wanted to get in there. What do you call that? They wanted to do, they wanted to have the upper hand there. You know, if you wait to be attacked, you know, you're not very smart. So they thought, they knew that that everybody was going to declare war, so they thought they'd do it first. So, and they had this plan already made out how to defeat France. So they declared war on France, which you're supposed to declare war before you ever invaded anybody. So that's why, you know, this is the rules of war. This is not just wild, irregular warfare by rebels and terrorists that we're used to now. But that's all been encouraged as the new kind of war since the 1980s or so. As soon as the Cold War ended, they were getting all this terrorism wars ready. So that's all fake too, it's all organized by the powers that be. But in this case, we're talking about Alsace. And, you know, Alsace is French and German, and often for long periods of time belonged to Germany. It's part of France now because of World War II. And so the French president, Hollande, hosted Joachim Gauck, and they get along just fine. I would say the Germans and the French are about as friendly as any of these countries are. I mean, they sincerely try to be, you know, close and neighborly and all that stuff. Not that I care for that, but Gauck went to Alsace to meet with Hollande on Sunday, yesterday, and to commemorate the 100th anniversary of this war declaration by Germany. So again, you know, he's the bad guy, Gauck is, and he's representing the bad guys. And they did their, there's nothing else there to say. just some information about the war in the Rhineland. Okay, that's, I'm not going to go into that anymore. Now, I've got a little more here called Different Approaches. This is from Der Spiegel. I don't know if I want to go into this. It's just, well, I will, since I've started talking about it. Germany denies reports of rift with UK over World War I centenary. But this is kind of, this is not real current. It's a little bit old, but this came up. I don't have a date on it, but I do kind of recall that it was a little bit old. But this problem came up a while back when they're planning all this commemoration, see. And it says, perhaps unsurprisingly, there are major differences in the way Germany and Britain commemorate World War I. For Germans, the memory is tainted not just by defeat and the chaos that followed, but by the crimes of World War II. See, now they got to get World War II in there, and Germans just can't win because they can't even just deal with World War I and their role. They can't defend themselves in their role in World War I because they've got the, because World War II makes them so guilty that they can never defend themselves ever again. So this article says the death, this is a part that I like, the death in 2008 of Eric Kästner, the last veteran believed to have served in the German Imperial Army, was largely ignored in Germany. By contrast, when Harry Patch, the last British veteran to have fought in the trenches, died in 2009 at the age of 111, there was live TV coverage of his funeral in Wells Cathedral. It was a similar story with the discovery in 2011 of the remains of 21 German soldiers in an underground shelter in Alsace. The news got little attention in Germany, but had those men been British, it would have dominated the front pages and TV documentaries would have traced their descendants. Even in Germany, this would have happened. See, Germany would have played up this along with Britain and everyone else, but it wouldn't play up its own. And this is from World War I. You know, World War I soldiers they're ignoring too. It's a bad, bad, sick result. And continually keeping up what I've just been telling you in this last half hour, the little that they do, they still can't quite, you know, take away the blame from World War I. They're too afraid that they might have some blame put on them, and mostly the British will never do it because they've got all those British deaths on their hands. Last time I'm going to say this tonight now. And they have to blame it on to somebody, that these men went out to fight for a cause, to save freedom and so on from these German Huns, which they know is not true. And all that has been admitted that it's not true, but they still carry on like this. And there's nobody to stop them because there's no Germany to complain and say, you know, you can't say those things. You know, that's not done. So, anyway, that's today's centennial celebration. Centenary, I discovered, is a word used in Britain, England. You know, but it's in the United States. It's always been centennial. So I decided to go with centennial, and not catered to the British so much. Now, I still have a little more. Oh, yeah, this was, somebody sent this to me, and it's a couple of reports from August 2nd, 1914. Now, Germany declared war on August 3rd, see, right? We just learned that. And then on August 4th, today, Germany marched into Belgium. So on August 2nd, there was an official war telegram It says of Prussia. I don't know, from Prussia, in Prussia, or by Prussia or something. The official war telegram that said, tonight was an attack against Russian patrols, the railway bridge over the Warta, Esheriad, instead. I don't know. This is a telegram. I don't know how to interpret that. Tonight was an attack against Russian patrols, or maybe there's they were patrolling a railway bridge, and Warta is in German, is in Prussian territory. Anyway, then it goes on to say a stronger Russian column had crossed the border at Schwedin. No, this is the explanation for it. A stronger Russian column had crossed the border at Schwedin with guns and two squadrons of Cossacks ride to Johannesburg. Johannesburg is the present Pease in the Polish Warmian, Missourian. Well, that was at one time Prussia. That was in Prussia, and now it's Poland. But so what happened was that I'm doing this kind of badly, but down a little further it says that there were 485,000 Russians who attacked, and there were only 173,000 Germans who were there who could come to the defense. So they were hopelessly inferior, the Germans, and these Russians had crossed the border into Prussia with guns and Cossacks, and they were riding to a certain place. And so far, the losses are about 20 men on the Russian side. On the German side, only several slightly wounded. Well, this was the news on August 2nd. And then there's another piece of news on the other side of the front with the French that says on August 2nd that a French department has crossed the German border in the Alsace places Repa. It is therefore clear that then the comment on that is that it's my comment is that it's clear that France as well as Russia attacked Germany first, without a declaration of war, just, you know how they do these border things. You see, they cross the border and start doing damage and killing people, you know, with guns and so on. And so the following day, Germany, seeing that they were coming at her from both sides, declared war on France and then marched into Belgium. So those are two interesting items that show that this was on a kind of on a page. I had to do it, Google Translate the page, so that's why it doesn't read very well, and have a hard time making it out. If I was prepared for it better, I could have told that in a shorter period of time. Sorry about that. And just said that there are these two border crossings, one by the Russians, other by the French, on August 2nd, the day before Germany declared war. So now I want to speak a little bit about the Baden-Nenndorf March. Paul Hickman told me a while back that he was going to be going to that, and he went with Richard Edmonds, who has gone before. And Richard Edmonds, who you should all be familiar with, he's a British nationalist politician, associated now with the National Front, as is Paul. And he's gone to a number of these marches called Ehrenmarsch, that's Honor March or Memorial March. You know, they have them in Dresden. They have them for various now, they don't have a whole bunch of them, but they have them for various things. And the story of this one, and the other person who went along was Peter Rushton, who Paul had on his program as a guest He interviewed him two or three weeks ago now on his program, Albion. I see my memory's bad, so I should know it, but something about Albion. Albion is the old name for Britain. Anyway, the story, he sent me the information about it, Paul did, and I asked him for everything he knew, and he came back, I guess they came back today, and he wrote that a book by Ian Cobain about British secret torture in various countries in the past included Baden Endor shortly after the war. And he said that the Guardian newspaper had picked it up and published an article in 2006. And, yeah, I'm familiar with that book. I haven't read the book, but I'm familiar with the Guardian article. I read a bunch of stuff about it back in October, and I did a program about it on the Heretics, on this Heretics Hour show, titled Sadists and Masochists, Tortured German POWs. Well, that's what I've got here on the link. And on October 29, 2012. So I'm familiar with the Baden Endorf story. It's a horrible, horrible story that after the war ended in the British zone, the British set up this prison there, probably had been a German prison or something, and they started arresting people that they wanted to interrogate, wanted to try to get information from, and it was just run by this sadist guy who was running some other things in Britain for prisoners of war, and under his under his overall control or direction, and they just did tortured people there. The torture included, according to Paul, I mean, a lot of it was starvation. They were absolutely starved. They looked worse than the people in the German camps that had typhus and so on. These didn't have typhus. They were actually starved. And the torture included freezing with ice-cold water and these people being left in minus 20-degree cold outdoors. Some of them lost toes, and some were made to stand back-to-back until they stuck together. They froze, their backs froze together. Those are some of the things they discovered going on at that place. Anyway, the NPD organizer for Hamburg, whose name is Steiner, suggested that there be a memorial march for this Baden Endorf camp or prison to publicize it. I don't know what other reason there would be. And to memorialize the victims, yeah, the German victims who suffered there, and a few of them died. Paul thinks the march is in its sixth year, and said that this Steiner, his goal is to get a plaque at the site to commemorate the Germans who were tortured there by the British. And this year the march took place on Saturday, and as I said, he said there are about 200 NPD, that's the German Democratic Party, the German National Party, I should say, National Party Deutschland, and the and there's a new party called the Right Party, Direkte. And they were a part of this too. And Paul says that there were many banners and signs along the march group. And they said things like, this is by the anti-racists, you know, that congregate there. And they said things like, all colors in Germany and no to Nazis and so on. But all colors in Germany, that's a horrible thing. These people hate Germany, I guess. I mean, these people are so sick, and there's so many of them, and they're young, too. And they're out there, you know, just hating Germany and Germans and wanting all colors of people to come to Germany and live there. And Paul thinks that, says that he thought the Socialist Council funded these signs. And when they reached the demo point where they were going to start their march, there were hundreds of red or communist, is what he means, protesters on the other side of the police vans. And there were signs high up saying party day, and the reds were playing loud music, dancing, and blowing whistles. That's what they do, so that if you try to, memorial marchers want to give a speech or give a talk, they're out there screaming and yelling so that nobody can hear what they have to say. They're the worst people in the world. They're just gross. Paul said there were several speeches by the Germans and by Peter Rushton and Richard Edmonds, who both spoke to the crowd. And Peter they've made a video, and Peter is going to put subtitles on it. It'll take about a week, and subtitles both in German and English for the various speakers. And he says he'll send me the video when it's done. And anyway, that was really nice of them. You know, I'm talking about the British, and there are these wonderful friends who are so sympathetic and helpful to the German nationalists. Of course, the nationalists all help one another and stick together, but Richard Edmonds is outstanding in that regard. And so now it turns out it's Peter Rushton, and so also our own friend Paul Hickman. So those three, they were there. He said there are many young people, naturally. They're the ones who show up, and about 20% female in the march, amongst the marchers. I don't know if they got to march. Last year they were prevented from marching because of the protesters. But I guess they marched because he didn't say they didn't. And a guy from the NPD was the organizer. So that's that. All right, let's see. It's almost at the top of the hour. Boy, I can tell you, I can really eat up the time. I'm thinking about playing a little, I'm going to go on to more about the Flatterhoff controversy and so on in the second hour. And I just might finish, I think I have some interesting and important things to say, and I need to say them, but I just might finish a little early tonight. And if I do, I'll take phone calls, and I can just end the program a little earlier too. That doesn't hurt anything. So I want to give you the phone number. It's 323-642-1206. And if you later on, a little bit later on, you want to make a phone call, call in, make a phone call. You want to call in and say anything after I get started talking about Flatterhoff. Or if you want to call in, if you have something you really want important about World War One or the Bad Nendorf March, you can call any time. But I think I'm going to play a little music tonight. I'm feeling pretty relaxed, and I have a couple of new pieces of music, but I want to warn you, they're pretty schmaltzy. I mean, they're going to sound schmaltzy. I was just looking around. I have a hard time finding the kind of, music that I would like, and I didn't have much time, but I started looking at German folk music, and I came upon some big collections of what they call German folk music. It sounds more like old-time German part, it would be folk music. But I was enjoying it. So I had a couple of them turned into MP3s, but, they are a little bit, they might sound a little bit schmaltzy, but if you give it a chance, they are actually nice pieces of music. And one has the vocal and one doesn't. And I think I'll just go ahead and play the longer one for now. It's 4 minutes and 40 seconds long. And when that's over, I'll be back, and we'll continue talking about the Flatterhoff speech that Hitler gave in 1944. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Did you enjoy that? I don't even know the name of it. I don't have it written down here. But So after that refreshing break, I want to say that on Saturday I talked about the Platterhouse speech and about Veronica Clark's and her book and various things. And then I afterwards I thought I really need to let people read this speech. And I hadn't really read it all that carefully in one big piece, you know. I kept reading it in parts. And so I have it now posted at my website in part one and part two. And I am now of the opinion that while it was not historically an important speech, I do think it's a very valuable speech in understanding Adolf Hitler better. I've got some things to say about it, after I talk about a few other things first. Some of the things I said on Saturday, after listening to that program, I would say it differently. One of them is, the kind of speech that I think it is. For one thing, it's very safe to say that he is not saying in that speech what Clark claims him to be saying. And that hasn't changed one bit. And it's even after I've read the whole thing, since, you know, it's better for me to read it like on my blog after it's been, you know, edited a little bit. And then I get it. And after maybe also talking about it and reading parts of it and for a while, it starts to sink in. And now the speech as a whole has, I think I finally have a grasp of it. So I'll say, I wrote this a couple days ago, but I don't know that I need to read this. Well, it's like Clark's view of Hitler her view of diversity and racial tolerance with regard to Hitlerism, Third Reich, and Hitler's Wehrmacht, and possibly also in the SS, is that ends up that whether you hate Hitler as an evil racist or you like Hitler as a more tolerant good guy, you are buying the New World Order point of view. What I'm trying to say here is that she is selling the New World Order point of view. And World Zionism is engaged on both sides of this issue, that either Hitler was actually believed in a united Europe and diversity amongst racial diversity amongst accepting Arabs and Indians and this, that, and the other thing. That's New World Order-ish. Or if you see Hitler as a evil racist or a real bad guy, well, then you're just still supporting the New World Order point of view that this is bad, you know, that diversity and tolerance is good and racism is bad, or racial thinking is bad. So I say that, my conclusion before I get started here is that Clark works toward a multicultural world order, no doubt about it. Though she has said, I'm not promoting multiculturalism, but she is, and she always has been. So I went back, excuse me. First, I'm going to talk about some comments that Veronica Clark made as VKC at the White Network in last December. And I had done a program, the one that was called The Problem with Nice, is what brought most of these out. But there were two programs that she wrote comments to. And I was surprised that she, well, I wasn't, because I talked about her. So that's why she first came on there. But she continued, and she said a lot of things, which I was happy to get down in print because I was, at that point, I, like so many people, had heard things about her and seen things that had her name attached to them, but I couldn't quite believe that, whether that, you know, I didn't know whether to believe that was really her or that was some kind of a hoax or what was going on. So finally she came on to the White Network comments for two of my programs, and I got to have a back and forth with her some, and it was very, I learned a lot about her. And I appreciated that she did come on, because I wanted to understand these things. One of the things she said in a comment on December 7th, 2013, so that was, you know, seven months ago or something, 8 months ago or whatever, not even a year, not even close to a year yet. And she said, amongst what she was complaining to me about in what I said on the program, she said, "Moreover, I am always very clear about who writes and translates what is in, should be, each of my books. None of them are frauds, as you wrote. I have had to do a lot of translating myself, since Wilf's original drafts are nearly unreadable in English." So she says she's always very clear about who writes and translates what's in each of her books, but that doesn't seem to be true, because she's got some books. For instance, this book in question, the Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, the one that has the Platterhoff speech in it, and also this Himmler speech, she says that this, she only has the names of, I hate bringing Wilf into this, but Wilf Hank and herself as the authors, and Wilf Hank as a translator. But then, now she goes on to say, "I have had to do a lot of translating myself, since Wilf's original drafts are nearly unreadable in English." So she's saying that what he sends her, she has to redo. And then further on down, if I can find just the right place here, she said on a comment, at the end of a comment on December 9th, see, this first was December 7th, then 2 days later on December 9th, she said, "The last point I must add is that Friedrich Berg translated several complicated portions of the speech. The version you read contains Berg's work, not just Hank's." Well, it can't, you see, what I read came from Wilf's original translation, not from her book. But the important part is, well, they're both important. She's saying that Berg translated part of that speech, but she doesn't have his name on the book at all. Therefore, she's not always very clear about who does what in her books. Now, continuing on, she's saying that what I read comes from the book, but it actually, what I have posted comes from Mr. Hank's original translation, which, according to him, he sent to her, and that's the last he ever heard about it. He wasn't interested. She asked him to translate it. He translated it without being very interested in it, or less interested as he went along, and sent it to her, and that's it. He didn't hear anything more. I mean, there was no more about it. He wasn't asked to redo it, or he wasn't asked anything. That was his original. And it's quite readable. It's quite readable, as you can see. But she was claiming in December that his original drafts are so unreadable that she has to do all this work on them, and then she has to get Fritz Berg to work on them. So then another thing I want to quote from her on the December 7th comment, she said, "Thank you for reading the part about Hitler saying that a folk is composed of many racial nuclei. This is what I I read in my on that radio program from December. She says that there is his admission that Germans are mixed race, not pure race. Now, that little part that I read, that little part that I'm going to go over again today, and that I went over on Saturday, and there's just actually a couple of sentences that she goes by. She says that alone is his admission that Germans are mixed race, not pure race, and that's what she bases it all on. A couple of sentences there, which I'll go over again in a little bit. And I say, you know, is any group a pure race? I mean, when she starts saying Germans are not a pure race, what does pure race mean? How many groups of people or national groups are such a pure race? Well, I said maybe the Hottentots are a pure race. But maybe there are some who are more pure than others. Maybe Germans are a little bit more mixed up than some others because I think that could very well be true because they're in the middle of Europe. You know, they're in a central location with lots of stuff going on, a lot of people all around and lots of history. that's never been disputed. But I don't know that anybody ever called him a pure race, and I don't know how you define a pure race either. And she doesn't try to do it. So again, in this December 9th comment, she had previously been talking about being a paleo liberal. That's what I couldn't think of last on Saturday. I said she was some kind of a libertarian. Well, she had said that she's a paleo liberal. And she sent me a couple of links to read about paleoliberalism, and it's considered to be a kind of extreme libertarianism, and which is super individualism. So I don't know if she, you know, and of course National Socialism is not at all individualistic, so this is strange that she gets attracted to National Socialism. When she chooses to be a paleo liberal in her private life. Anyway, let's see. She says to me, she writes a comment to me, Carolyn, as for the NSDAP not adhering to pure race notions at any point, I refer you to this, because I guess I said there was nobody claimed that Germans were a pure race. And so she refers me to a link to Stephen Books, UK, and it's a publisher, and this is a product description of something by A.J. Greger, a synopsis of his work. I don't know if it's a particular book that he wrote, but supposedly this A.J. Greger is supposed to convince me that what he says is right. I don't even know who he is, you see, but he's written something. And this is what he's written. I have time, so I'll just read it. This serious look at the racial policies of the Third Reich. Well, this is not him. This is the publisher writing a blog about his book or part of a book, whatever, that he's contributed. So this is being written about him and about his book, which I didn't check into. I didn't check it. I probably did before, but I didn't this time. I didn't go to the link. But it says, this serious look at the racial policies of the Third Reich explains how the vague ideas of Adolf Hitler in the early years of his political struggle developed in the 1930s into an exaggerated obsession with Nordicism. This is supposedly what Gregor says. This occurred quite separately and with the disapproval of many of the National Socialist leaders. There was some schism that may be the ones that he would have been referring to. By the late 1930s, a far more rational view became official policy. The entire history of these developments are explained by Dr. Greger, What is important about this work is that it refutes the silly media and propaganda allegations by the court historians and demolishes all the lurid tales of blonde beasts and master races. Over 100 footnotes are provided giving references and sources. Well, this sounds like something that Clark would like, and she would look into. But obviously, I say here that possibly Clark is confusing the phrase Hitler's alleged obsession with Nordicism with a German pure race, that if they talk about Nordicism in National Socialism or by Hitler, that is the same as saying a German pure race. But nobody ever said that Germans were all Nordic. So anyway, then she says, I already read this part about Berg translating some of the work on that speech. So according to Veronica Clark, that speech in her book was translated by Will Hank, but then it was, she did some work on it. She doesn't say she just did editing on it. I do editing on translations, but I don't do usually, not in any serious way, I don't do the translating. But she says that she had to do a lot of translating work on it. And then, or work on the translation, maybe she said. But that Friedrich Berg had to work on several complicated portions. But he's not mentioned as far as I know, as being part of the, as being one of the translators. Then, going on. Okay. On December 14th, she wrote a comment, and it's fairly short, but at the end of it, she spoke about white nationalism and the white network. And I thought this was just interesting. It doesn't have anything to do with the Flatterhoff, but she says, I do not intend to encroach on the white movement in any way, as I have, nobody said anything about that as far as I know, but anyway, that's what she says. As I have never been part of it, nor am I interested in it. Having said that, I do have a serious question for you and others in this movement. What makes white nationalists, in parentheses, the white network, if you will, think that you can succeed where Hitler himself failed? Well, I thought that was very interesting. She says she feels that what did Hitler fail at? Obviously, what she's saying is he failed in keeping a white German nation and a white Europe. He failed in the pursuit of a white Europe. And Clark is admitting by saying this that she thinks that keeping any nation white is impossible. And so it's a waste of time. What makes white nationalists think that they can succeed in keeping nations white when Hitler himself failed? So she has given up on it. She never cared about it, but she's trying to tell us. And this has been her message that I got from her the very first emails we exchanged, just my email to her and her email back to me, just that. That was clear already that she didn't think it was a reasonable goal to try to keep a country white, and that therefore let's work together with these Mexicans and blacks and so on against the Jews. That's what she said. And this is what she's saying here too, many number of years later, still that there's no, it's impossible for there to be white nations anymore. Then on December 15th, she said, as for my being out of tune with Hitler, I guess I said that to her, that is irrelevant. I came across Antonio Muñoz's works on the German Axis military, and that was what spawned my interest in the subject in the first place. Hitler sabotaged his many chances at victory, and that's nothing to envy or gloat about, in my opinion. Well, that's pretty strong, too. It was Antonio Munoz who, she says, was where her interest in the whole subject got started in German or the Axis military, whatever. That's all she says, it's just military, but, you know, the military history and whatever she could learn about it. So she's interested in the military success or failure, she thinks, and of course she did get her this degree in military history. And she got started on that from this Antonio Munoz. But then she says, Hitler sabotaged his many chances at victory, and that's nothing to envy or gloat about, in my opinion. Well, boy, she's really, to use the word sabotage, she didn't say he failed at him or he lost his chances or he, you know, screwed him up or anything. She uses the word sabotage, meaning that, you know, he didn't really want victory anyway, after all. And that goes along with that whole conspiracy theory that Hitler was actually working for the other side and wasn't what he said he was and what we think he was. And see, I don't know if sometimes she gets angry or something, and so she, you know, says things. She says more than she would otherwise, you know, reveals her feelings more. She's angry at Hitler, maybe, but to call him a saboteur is quite amazing. And I think I just let it go by because there were so many things she was saying, and I wanted to ask her about. And maybe, but I didn't look at all my answers too much right now. So, but anyway, that's interesting, right? And so now I want to talk about Antonio Munoz, which I know she has taken things he has written and put them in her books, and she's spoken about him a lot. And I thought she, at one time, she was had a friend from Mexico, and I was confusing this Antonio Munoz with her friend. Well, sometimes she mentions, I think, a Luis, L-U-I-S, Luis Munoz, and this might be a name for this Mexican friend of hers, but you can't deny that Antonio Munoz is who she actually is referring to, because she talks about one of his books, I looked him up, and he is the person. He's written a lot of regular books, but then he's the author of a few books on German military and non-whites of all kinds, and also Balkan countries and I guess maybe call it Slavic countries in, here's the book. Let's see, what does it say? He's written a book called Hitler's Green Army, the German Order Police and their European Auxiliaries, 1933-1945. And there's several volumes of it. This particular one is Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And it says it came out in 2006, so it's very recent. Then one of his best-known books that she has mentioned, Veronica has mentioned, is The East Came West. And the subtitle of that is Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist Volunteers in the German Armed Forces. Oh, that's right up her alley. Boy, she must have grabbed hold of that when she saw that. And he really influenced her. And this is dated from 1941 to 1945 that these volunteers came into the German Armed Forces. And it was published in January 2002 by Antonio J. Munoz And then a third book of his I have mentioned here, Lions in the Desert, Arab Volunteers in the German Army. So again, it's all this very, this is, where does she come up with black Nazis? Well, she doesn't get anything originally from herself. It all came from Antonio Munoz first, and then she got into it. He wrote this in 1999, this book. And he's got a bunch of books. Reading about him, he's got a, he's got a Wikipedia page, and I looked at, I got some things from there, but it doesn't say he's Spanish. It doesn't say he's Jewish. He's got a pretty good sized nose. I mean, he could be Jewish, he could not be Jewish. I don't know. But it doesn't give any information about his parents, you see. It says where he was born. I forget now, somewhere in Spain. And what he's done and where he's eventually moved to New York. He was currently living in New York writing and blah, blah. But here's the thing, in 2013, last year, he won the Jerusalem Prize at the Jerusalem International Book Fair, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. This is supposed to be kind of a big thing. Antonio Munoz Molina. Well, here this is, he's Antonio J. Munoz. Let's see, it says, the fair is a biennial event that attracts dozens of Israeli and international authors, as well as hundreds of publishers, held in February. The Jerusalem Prize, which was announced Tuesday, is awarded to a writer whose work best expresses and promotes the idea of the freedom of the individual in society. Five authors who have won the prize have subsequently received the Nobel Prize in Literature. How surprising. Molina's books emphasize a strong bond to international culture, literature, and history. Some of his work reflects the far-reaching changes that have taken place in Spain as it transitioned from dictatorship to democracy, excuse me. Spain transitioning from dictatorship, it has to be Franco, right, to democracy, exposing traumatic collective memories, meaning that under dictatorship there are a lot of traumatic memories, you know. So he's very much internationalist. The reason that I was sure that I'm not sure, Antonio Munoz Molina, I'm going to have to go check that all out again. But the one that she's talked about his books, and the one who's written a lot of books that have nothing to do with this and then has also written, unless it's a different Antonio Munoz, it's on the same page. His Amazon gets mixed up and puts the same names people on there. So this might not be the one who won the Jerusalem Prize, but he did write these books about the East came West, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist volunteers in the German armed forces, Hitler's Green Army, the German Order Police and their European auxiliaries, Eastern Europe and the Balkans, and then he's got some others, Lions of the Desert, Arab Volunteers in the German Army. These are by this Antonio J. Munoz. So, now, I'm going to skip down now to the speech. About the speech itself, I made a kind of an outline of the speech because I didn't think I was representing it very well. And let me say again, if anybody wants to call in this show, we've got a half hour left. The number is 323-642-1206. Okay, now I went through the speech and tried to read it pretty carefully. And now I've done an outline. It's not really an outline, but a kind of a, I made notes of each part that I thought, you know, was important that he talked about. And I end up with 24 points, you might say, out of the whole thing. Actually turned out to be 12 in each one, just happened that way. And out of the 24 major points that I've discovered here, I've written down, only two are about this race talk, the talk about race. So, and I knew from reading it that it was a minor part of his talk, but I'm not saying it's not important. What he says about it is important and it's very interesting, but it's not what the speech was about. It's just one aspect of it. But I did say on Saturday, which I shouldn't have, I'm sorry that I did, I was thinking in terms of table talk and how Hitler says a lot of things in table talk that I wouldn't, make real important. Although he talks about them often enough, it means he really thinks that way. But giving a speech to officers like this, it's not the same as sitting around the dinner table and chatting and, you know, doing kind of soliloquies on how he's, what he thinks, what he's thinking about at that time. So that was a bad comparison, and I would say that that this speech is, I may have already said this in the beginning, I don't know, but it's certainly not a real important speech, but it's a very interesting speech. It reveals a lot about Hitler, and it has taught me a lot about how to understand what he means by things, and he's actually describing, the way I see it, he wants to get these are his top officers, and he wants to get them to support what he's trying to do, and he wants to get their not so much their loyalty, but he wants them to believe in him. He wants them to see him in a light of somebody who knows what he's doing, and that so that they will have confidence in him and in what he's asking of them. That's what he's, because he reveals a lot about himself. He talks about how he came about to understand this and do that, and talks a whole lot about his inner feelings, beliefs, and his journey, his life journey, and so on. That's what's so interesting about it. And I believe it's, he believes you have to persuade people, he believed, to if you're asking them to do something or you want to sway them into a certain way of thinking, you have to do a good job of persuading them. And this is what he says he's been doing all his life. But he was doing it here in this speech. And I think he wanted them to see him as sincere and real. And he really did, I think, speak openly about himself. He's not being calculated or, well, he may have thought through what he said, what he was going to say, but I think he is sincere. And I think he wanted them to see him that way. It always seemed as though when he was talking to officers, whether this big group here or just a few of them, about certain things, that he was always able, usually, to persuade them to see it his way. They were always convinced by him. But as I've said before, when they went away, some of them didn't remain convinced. They just, you know, kind of shrugged that off after they got out from his presence and so on and got away for a little while. But he was always very persuasive, because he thought he had real depth of reasoning and purpose behind what he was trying to do. He didn't just have an idea in his head. He could back it up with a lot of strong content that you would that made sense to people. It all made sense. So I think he makes a lot of sense in this speech. And now the first thing that I have for my little main point is that he was talking about the non-political status of the officers in the Wehrmacht, and that they had to, in the past, they had always pledged their loyalty to the Constitution. And he was saying, like, that the Constitution was a kind of a no thing, and it wasn't anything you could be loyal to. That's what they're doing again now. Everything is the Constitution in the Federal Republic of Germany. But during Hitler's time, they pledged their loyalty to him personally, or to the Führer, which whom he was. And the second point that he talked about was that how the troops identify with the officers. They want to follow someone they have confidence in. They want to follow someone, and the best commanders are the ones that they like best, and so on. They see through the ones who aren't sure of themselves or who aren't good commanders, and so on. So leadership, again, this speech was mostly about leadership. That's what he's talking about, basically, all the way through it. And he was referring to the leadership within the military and these officers having to be strong, having to recognize that they're leaders and take that responsibility, and also leadership in the home front, or I don't know what you call it, in the government, the ministers in his government, that kind of leadership, the civilian leadership. Okay, civilian leadership and military leadership. So the third point was he's saying, yeah, that you need good leadership in the military, but you also need leadership with the folk. And his main theme is the unity of the German folk, how important unity is, and the unity of the Wehrmacht officers. And the unity of their troops with them, and you know, all leaders have to create a sense of unity among their followers, and then everybody's happy. That's what the followers want. And my number four point was, he said that he was convinced that we would succeed, and he talked a lot about his own life story, his struggle, and why he believed he was the right man to be Führer, and what had the things that he had gone through in life that had helped him to develop his strong will and his belief. And he thought that, that's probably coming up. So number five is, I studied intently because for me, life is a complete manifestation and not something that needs to be solved. I thought that was, when I thought about that, I thought that's really a fantastic understanding that he has, that life is not something to be solved, and he doesn't look at it as that he needs to solve something, but more like it needs to be understood because it's complete. There's nothing wrong with life. You know, we complain about life, right? Oh, this and that. I wish this was different, and oh, this is not fair, and oh, we complain about life all the time, want to fix it. But he's saying that there's nothing wrong with life as it comes. It just needs to be understood, not changed or something fixed in it, or something or solved, or something made better, or whatever. That's very, very mature thinking, if you ask me. Now, number six is he was talking about being well educated. He said he was well educated as a young man, but he was lumped in with the proletarians, and because of his lack of opportunities in life, and so he says he learned a lot from all of that, and he talks about that a bit. And then seven, he believes having absolutely firm convictions leads to success. He believed from the beginning that he would be the Führer of Germany. He said when he stood before to give his first speech to those followers in that little party, he said he knew then that he was going to be the Führer of Germany. I believe he did have those kind of feelings, because people do. Once in a while, you just suddenly know something, and it seems outlandish at the time, but it ends up turning out to be true. So number eight, in all this, he's trying to connect with these officers and get who some of them might be still look down on him, or they might not have any faith in him, and he's explaining to them how he got where he is and why he deserves to be there, really. And so in number eight, he says the only difficulties are inner difficulties. I mentioned that on Saturday, I think, because that's another one. I think that's a fantastic statement that he makes, and that's he really did believe that he really lived that. And that's why he would never give up, and a lot of people fault him for that. And maybe rightly so, I don't know, but this was he had come to believe that everything could be overcome. If you believed in it, if you didn't let yourself get down about it, and it's the inner, it all comes from the inner. If you see it, if you think it's too difficult, well, then you've already lost it. He never wanted to allow himself to believe that anything was too difficult to accomplish. He said, a quote, "I value determination, true determination, higher than this so-called intelligence or genius, the determination to pursue something, accept it as valid, and to not capitulate no matter what." He's saying he values determination higher than intelligence or genius. So, nine, he was talking about that the state is convinced that life is a struggle, a battle, an eternal battle, a principle that each officer must accept as his own, naturally, for he could never be an officer without it. I don't know, that's not worded quite right, but he says the present state, he says, I think he means the Third Reich state under as the National Socialist state, goes by the conviction that, I can't get rid of this, that life is a struggle, a life is a battle, an eternal battle, and this is what the officer corps must accept this too. That it's an eternal battle, and because he was talking about those soldiers who don't want to fight, or those who are conscripted or drafted or whatever, but say what is that called? No, there's nobody here to answer me. The peaceful people who don't want to ever hurt anybody, and He's Hitler is explaining there why, and he makes a good case for it, why a human who is unwilling to fight is unfit to live, because life is a fight. Life is an eternal battle to live, and if you're unwilling to fight, you're unfit to live. But of course, there's a lot of people who won't fight in a war, they say, but that doesn't mean they don't fight otherwise. Of course, they do. They struggle for life just like everybody else does. But in any case, that's what he was saying. And number, what I have is the 10th point, which precedes his commentary about race. He said, the breakdown in 1918 was the beginning of a new national body. What he is going to say, he says, what I'm going to say to you next, I would not say to the masses. And what he says to them, the essence of it is, our people are not to be defined as a race. They are composed of up to five different racial nuclei, all European. I say that. He gives them, and they're all European. But this is this is one of the two parts that I said had to do with race, the race issue. And this one and the next one. There's only two in the whole 24 of them. And so he's saying that he would not say to the folk that you're not a race. He doesn't say that to them. He's telling the officers that he's telling this to them for whatever reason, because he thinks it'll help them understand some of the other things he's going to say, I guess. And they're, you know, more educated and on a different level or something. And so he says, you know, that I'll say it to you, that we can't think of them as a race. But what he says from here on is going to show why he's saying that. Well, at least it says what he's doing, why he looks at it that way. So the 11th is, then he goes on to say, after describing this, what I just told you, he says, after going through all that talk about the racial nuclei that I read on Saturday, and that you can read in the speech as you read it yourself, you know, and the Nordic and the Mediterranean and the Alpine and the old European and the prehistoric and so on. After going through all that, he says, we now have a combination of these racial nuclei within our people. However, it is now crucial, because of the multitude of abilities in the German people, that I encourage those racial nuclei to emerge, which are the original carriers of these abilities. In other words, I must see to it that the talents of a particular racial nucleus gradually emerge throughout the entire German people. That's it. So he's saying that that the German people are not as uniformly excellent, you might say, as he wants them to be. They're not yet as uniformly, as evenly talented and capable. There's quite a bit of variation in them, but he is going to encourage, his plan is to encourage the best racial traits, you might say, to emerge in the people. And then he identifies the Nordic as what he considers the most valuable, and wants to increase the Nordic for its organizational skills, because he's looking at his big plan for the Germans to rule over Greater Germany, a larger Germany yet, and also eventually a united Europe. And so he sees the German people as he's trying to make the German people more able to do all this and become even better leaders and organizers than they are, and bring that out in more of the population. So he does have quite a big eugenic plan here, according to this speech. And people could call it, you know, that he's trying to create the master race. You certainly could call it that, but it's a vision that he has, but he's far from accomplishing it. But he is identifying the Nordic as what is most valuable for leadership and organizational ability. Well, you know, the Germans are also already famous for organizational ability. And I was criticized not long ago for my programs being disorganized. But I tell you, if you had to organize a couple of these two-hour shows a week and then do another third one in between and get all this information and be totally organized, you try it, you people who are saying that. I have always been a very good organizer. I'm a very organized person, But some things are just are more than I can do well every day after day. However, he wants that, he wants to even improve that organizational ability or make it or bring it into more and more of the German people. Now, the 12th item, he says that in a capitalistic society, only the children of the wealthy will be the future leaders of the country. He talks about that for a while, about finding talent, and he says that in that case, talent is lost when it's when you're only looking to those who can send their children to college, to universities and pay for it. He says it's therefore essential when constructing society, and it's interesting he uses the word constructing society, and is in ways he's wanting to do that, to place at the front those who are able to lead. It's essential to put the leaders in the front and not go by wealth of the parents as to who your leaders are going to be, because they might not be the best people at all. So, I thought that's pretty good. And I don't see, I'm quite okay with his ideas about improving society and bringing the best racial traits out and making them, spreading them around more widely through, I guess, the, well, you know, it's not going to be that scientific, but this is the idea. And because of the way he describes it, and because of what I know that he, what he was hoping for, I wouldn't mind living under that or having those kind of ideas guiding the society I live in. I think it'd be very good, actually. So there we go with that whole controversy about eugenics and whether it's good or bad, of course. But I want to move on here to part two, because that was just part one, and that was the only place where that racial talk took place. In part two, I have 12 points too, and he continues talking about molding and unifying society. For if we now talk of a folkish society, we have to acknowledge that it can only be built up and be preserved under an able leadership. This could never, never happen in a multicultural society. The more diversity in a society, the weaker it is as far as unifying goes. Well, now he said that. He said that in that speech. Now that's pretty clear, isn't it? If he says what he wants, a folkish society could never, a folkish society can only be preserved under a good leadership, he says, and this could never, never happen in a multicultural society. And then he says the more diversity in a society, the weaker it is as far as unifying goes, as far as being united. And so there is, I would say to Veronica Clark, there is Hitler's admission that he never accepted that the German folk could be diverse, because she said above that this statement that that he made about race was an admission that he didn't think the Germans were a race. Well, if all it takes is one sentence, then I can say that by these two sentences, he is saying that he doesn't believe in diversity, and he would never think that the German folk, as a folk, could be a diverse group. He wants more and more sameness in them, not diversity. So that's just as strong as what she comes up with. And I was happy to see that. Now, the second point here in part two is raising and training the Volk from boyhood to manhood and on. And he talked about how they were, they got the same message all the way through, always the same message, so that eventually it was just part of them. That's what some people would call brainwashing, but it's what happens anyway, and if it's a good message, I'm all for it. But he still says, you know, he lets the people develop naturally. He says you can't force anybody into something. Let them do what they like best. And he used the example of a boy who might show a lot of promise, but at the time that they're, you know, looking at him or maybe testing him, he liked boxing. He just wanted to box. So let him go and box until he's ready to go to maybe more serious things. So then Hitler said that, and he was like that too. I mean, he wasn't a didactic, forcing people into things kind of person. Now, the third point, the people, he makes the point that the people will know under his system, under his National Socialist leadership, that their children can aspire to be the very highest. He's mentioned mothers who can know that the child that they're carrying, the pregnant women can know that the child that they're carrying can be anything. It can reach to the very highest. And this is what Hitler was promising to the German people under his system of meritocracy. And, you know, what came to my mind was that this was supposed to be what only the United States of America offered. Remember, in the USA, any little boy can grow up to be president, you know, and this was what the United States offered, supposedly, but actually Adolf Hitler offered it under National Socialism. And number four was he's talking about that he believes in the selection process, natural selection, which I'm then extrapolating to Darwinian. But he talked about that a bit, actually. He did spend some time on that. And then he talked about all great men and great historical achievements have to overcome crises, even catastrophes. And he went into all the crises that he's experienced in his life and in building the party and now in the war, and that these just had to be seen as the more crises you overcome, the greater your achievement in the end and so on. So, you know, not to let those turn you away or get you down. And the sixth here was the problem of the social order. That he had to deal with the problem of the social order as he was building up his party and working to become the Führer and the Chancellor. And even after that, the social order he described as like communist versus capitalist, nationalist versus internationalist. And he said that they couldn't just ignore the Marxists. They had to deal with them and bring them into the whole thing somehow. They had to do something about them. They couldn't just ignore them. And then he said that he came up, his answer to all this was the new popular concept that I assume he means National Socialism by that. And then he said that ruthless treatment of Jews to save the Germans and to prevent counter-revolution was necessary. He said that he used the word ruthless in his treatment of Jews. Maybe he exaggerated a little bit, but he said that that it was all to save the Germans. If you didn't get rid of the Jews, they were going to destroy the Germans, and it also prevented counter-revolution. That was another part of it, and he said that Jews cause decay and corrode the state, and said a lot of other things too. I'm going to go over just a little bit, so those of you who are listening live, you'll hear me get cut off, and so when that happens, but I'm almost to the end, so you can catch the rest of it afterwards. I think you're gone already. So then number 10, he was talking about all the different regions in Germany that had their own distinctive customs and traits and not traits, but, you know, characteristics and their own distinctive histories and things that tied them together individually. And he said all these regions had to give up that independence to create a united Germany. But he said that the united Germany was greater than any of these individually, and it was worth it. But he realizes that it was difficult for them to do it. And he named some of them and talked about them a little bit. And then 11, he said the National Socialist Party sees to it that all the people know they have to fight. He talks about this quite a bit, that in Germany today, everybody knows that they have to fight. Everybody. The civilians and the military and everyone. He says the soldier officer must continue this education of the people that begins in childhood and continue it with the men under their command. With this education in place, he says 1918 could not be repeated. He says what happened in 1918 was that the people were all individuals, and they all thought they could, they had their own ideas and so on, and they didn't hang together. They weren't united as Germans very well, and they got tired of the war, and they started joining up with the communists and so on, and all that betrayal took place. But he says today that's not the way it is because of his National Socialism, and the party has seen to it that the people are educated from childhood on up, and they keep getting this education, and they all have the same education, and they think the same, and it's all natural to them, and they know that they have to fight for their country, and they will. I think this is rather beautiful. If you're allowed to have a country, which really today is not allowed, it's not allowed today, and it's very depressing to consider how probably what he's talking about is not out of reach, and what he did there could not be repeated today, but I don't want to get too negative. So number 12 is that you needed the courage, that decision-making took courage, and that leaders had to make decisions. And that the masses were not able to decide and should not be expected to decide, but they can only agree or not afterward. But the leaders have to make these decisions, and if they make bad decisions, well, maybe they won't continue to be leaders, but they still have to make those decisions. So again, as I say, this whole speech, when you take it as a whole, it's not about Hitler's ideas it's not at all about Hitler changing any of his ideas or making an about face about race and now embracing a more diverse point of view and seeing a Germany that is more open to other races, because he understands now. He's admitted that the Germans are not a race, and therefore they're not pure, and so he doesn't have to protect them as a race or any of that. It's not about that at all. He talks about this race business in order to explain how he's planning to improve the German people, who he already thinks are the best people, but he knows they can become better, and what would make them better, what he thinks would make them better, because it would make them better leaders, and he sees Germans as being the leaders, the leadership group of Europe, and not to harm Europe, not to take over Europe or brutalize Europe, but to make Europe safer, stronger, greater, and a happier, better place. And certainly not a racially mixed place. Nowhere does that come in at all. So she's, back to Veronica Clark, she's all wet. And anybody who has heard any of this from me or will really look at any of this, that's why I went ahead and posted this speech, because I thought it just has to be posted and made available so people can see what's really in it. Anybody who will still listen to Miss Clark go on and on about her great book about the Platterhouse speech, and I hope that John Friend is listening, and I hope that he will think about this and start taking some things a little more seriously, and not just see people as guests who will make for an interesting program that will get some people to listen to it. That's not what we're out to do. And I think he's got enough sincerity in his purpose and mission, hopefully, that he will consider that he doesn't want to put out that kind of false thinking, and maybe he will reassess this speech. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all for tonight, and I would like to tell you that I'm feeling very chipper right now, but I feel I'm having a few a minor type of health issues, and I've been trying to do something about it, and I think I feel like I'm going through something of a healing crisis, and I want to go all out with it so that I can get it over with rather than drag it out. So I may not do a show on Saturday. I will be doing the Thursday show. There's no reason not to do the Thursday Hitler Table Talk because I have a partner there with me, and it makes it a lot easier, and it's not difficult to do. But I might not do a show on Saturday, but I may need to take some time off here. But I will, if I don't do a Saturday show, I'll no doubt be back on Monday because I don't usually can't go that long without thinking I have some things I need to say. So if I don't see you on Saturday, well, I hope you have a nice weekend coming up. And this is after all the month of August, and that's month of vacation time. And a lot of people are probably going on vacation. So, and spending a lot of time outdoors and in outdoor activities. So in any case, I'm not going away for good at all. And I will see you next on Thursday with Hitler's Table Talk. Thanks for listening tonight, and good night.